welcome to episode 25, the silver anniversary of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. Thank you for joining us. We are lawyers talking about technology, security, privacy, and government. And I'm joined today by Maury Schenck from Steptoe's London office, but here in the Washington, D.C. studio of Steptoe & Johnson. Michael Vadas, formerly with the FBI and the Justice Department, now in our New York office. And our guest commentator today is Ralph Langner. Welcome, Ralph. Founder of Langner Communications and known for having done the definitive analysis of the Stuxnet malware. I'll introduce him in more detail when we get started with our interview. I'm Stuart Baker, formerly with NSA and DHS, holding the record for returning to Steptoe & Johnson to practice law more times than any other lawyer. So let's get started with the week in review. We're back to regular This Week in NSA features. There have been three or four things that have happened in connection with the Snowden disclosures. Probably the most interesting is that the House, rather unexpectedly, but by a very large vote, roughly 3-1, passed an amendment to the National Defense Authorization Act that doesn't deal with the 215 metadata program where phone data about all American calls was pulled together for NSA. Instead, it's an effort to regulate what I would call secondary searches of data gathered under the 702 program. That's the program where NSA is authorized to gather information about calls that touch the United States and another country. And in the course of that, a lot of information that includes calls of Americans is gathered, even though the program, by and large, is focused on non-Americans, since some of the calls or the emails or other materials touch the United States. Often there'll be an American on the other side of that communication. When the data has been lawfully gathered under the 702 program, it is stored by NSA, where it can be searched later, using a variety of search terms. This is not a surprise. But what the House essentially did was to say that even though NSA has gathered all of this information lawfully, it cannot search for Americans without meeting the standards for obtaining a search warrant, essentially probable cause. That's going to be a big complication for what had been previously fairly routine searches, and creates yet another set of rules for certain kinds of searches by NSA employees, which all of which slows down and makes much more complicated the job of finding intelligence from the data that NSA has. That said, my guess is that this bill isn't going to go anywhere. It was put in during an open vote. The House leadership allowed anyone to offer an amendment as long as it was debated for only 10 minutes. This got 10 minutes of debate and received an overwhelming vote in favor, but it didn't have any support in the authorizing committee of the House, and it's unlikely to have any support in the authorizing committee of the Senate, and therefore my guess is that when the Senate takes it up, they will not include this in their in the bill that passes the Senate, and when it goes to conference, probably will not survive. But that remains to be seen. So we will we'll be following this new form, new legislative amendment, pretty closely. It looks like it's at least as close as the 215 legislation to passing this year. Dumbest NSA Story of the Month award goes to Andrea Peterson of the Washington Post, who exposed NSA's shocking use of something called skills points to encourage the use of new tools inside the agency's database. Skills points are just a mechanism for encouraging people to use the agency's databases more effectively. But Andrea Peterson and the Washington Post thought that there was some kind of scandal there and decided to write a story on it. I still can't quite figure out why. Beyond that, GCHQ is facing a fair amount of hostile press over the decision to extract Yahoo and Hotmail and other information without following the rules for internal communication intercepts. GCHQ has released a paper saying we're entitled to treat email that goes to Hotmail as an external communication, and we can seize it without following the rules we ordinarily would for internal domestic communications. That decision seems to be provoking a little more than usual attention in the UK, although the NSA disclosures have not gotten an enormous amount of traction in the UK. This one might. What do you think, Maury?
Well, there's a free newspaper they give away on the tube, the subway in the UK, and this, I think, made the front page of that. So the public...
Did it have a back page, or is this one of those...
No, it's you know, usually 50 pages long,
okay.
And it was on the front page. So this is gotten public attention in the UK, that the idea that social media can be seized, I think people do care about, and
I suspect they don't think of it as a foreign a system. You know, yes, it's an American system, but Facebook and Hotmail feel pretty domestic.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and the focus was on the report that it was the UK government that said it could take this information. So I think everybody is thinking, these are my services and my government is accessing them willy-nilly.
Yeah, so it will be interesting to see whether this finally, someone when I went over there last for the Oxford Union debate, a government official said, the Snowden disclosures have left the British public neither shaken nor stirred, but maybe this will stir them if not shake them.
I'm not sure if I quite get the Bond analogy, although it was nicely put.
I think that's it. We only say it because we can nicely put it.
But yeah, the British public hasn't been shocked by this stuff like I think in Germany, the New Year's the New Year's performance apparently was obsessed with making fun of the U.S. NSA. The Germans really are upset about this.
Yes, Ralph has volunteered to talk a little bit about
so this. Ralph will know it better than I do. In the UK, very much not the case. Very different. I think there's a less aggressive attitude towards, or less protective attitude towards privacy in the UK. But people do seem to care about this latest revelation. I think it's too early to say exactly where it's going to go.
Well, let's come back to that and to Ralph as soon as we finish up the rest of the news. This week in LabMD, Michael, I know Jason is sorry not to be here to talk about Daryl Issa and the questions that he has raised about the FTC's investigation. He's now asked for an Inspector General investigation of the FTC's investigation. Can you tell us what's going on there?
Sure. You know, Michael Daugherty, the CEO of LabMD, has made allegations that the entire FTC investigation was basically corrupted by this company called Tyversa, which found the medical data on the web that was shared through a peer-to-peer network and allegedly showed the information to LabMD and said, hey, hire us to fix your security, and this will all stay on the down low. And LabMD said no. And then, according to Daugherty, Tyversa went to the FTC to embarrass LabMD for not hiring Tyversa. Daryl Issa has gotten a hold of this and has now sent a letter to the FTC acting inspector general saying he wants an investigation into this. Is there something wrong with the way the FTC receives information about alleged inadequate security, and is it in cahoots with Tyversa somehow? So, you know, to some extent, this may all be a sideshow to the whole case against LabMD, but it is certainly causing a stir on the Hill, and I don't know, there may be an investigation into us and whether we're in cahoots with LabMD for giving us so much attention.
Yeah, well, I think that's right. After all, we had them on the show. We had a 5-minute conversation with Daugherty. I think actually it's probably safe for us to just make popcorn and watch this one.
It is fun. I mean, there's all sorts of allegations flying back and forth, and now the Tyversa CEO is saying a lot of this stuff has come to light because he fired a former employee. So, you know, the allegations just keep getting slung around, and it's becoming complicated and difficult to follow. But all the while, the FTC is just plowing ahead with its case against LabMD for having inadequate security. And I think it's important to remember that all the articles are about how this one file of information was made publicly available on LimeWire, but the FTC has at least belatedly made lots of other allegations about bad security practices at LabMD. So the case is broader than just what's being focused on in the press.
I think that's right, but it's also true that the FTC staff has never really been pulled up short. They've always been able just to say we found something bad. It was in the newspapers. We got sent out a subpoena and figured out that there was some bad security practices, and now we're launching our investigation and imposing our consent decree. They've never really had a tough review of the mechanisms by which they build those investigations, and now they're going to get one. So I think this is likely to be problematic for the FTC's investigative processes, if nothing else.
Yeah, I think you're probably right, and you're certainly right that there has been really no scrutiny of the FTC's practices in these cases, since every case other than the LabMD case and the Wyndham case has settled. So there's never any scrutiny at all of their investigations into cybersecurity. So, yeah, it'll be interesting. A hard look by a congressional committee at an agency's practices always finds something that can be faulted, whether fairly or not. So the FTC isn't going to enjoy being on the receiving end.
I always said that about the GAO. They don't come to tell you that you've done a great job. They come to criticize you, and the question is how bad the criticism is going to be. Well, speaking of criticism, the Irish Data Protection Authority had a complaint, one of the few pieces of litigation to actually arise from the NSA scandals. There's the one or two cases in the United States, and then a set of cases against Facebook and Google, mainly centered in Ireland, all of them arguing that the U.S. Has not provided adequate protections for personal data, and therefore cannot be receiving information under the safe harbor. Maury, you looked at those cases, didn't you? There's been some developments, most of them not particularly favorable to the privacy claimants, but the issues may now be getting very high level attention.
Yeah, the most interesting bit is the development at the Irish High Court in the last week or two, where the High Court said, it was in a case of Europe v. Facebook, was the name of the group, a student group that challenged it, and the Irish High Court.
So this is now Europe v. Facebook v. Facebook.
Something like that. Yes, right. Irish High Court said, well, Facebook has made these transfers under the safe harbor. You haven't alleged any violations of the safe harbor processes. Therefore, we think there's no case because Facebook is following the safe harbor. However, in a surprising development about a week ago, the High Court has asked the European Court of Justice whether they are permitted to consider the legitimacy of the safe harbor in deciding whether there should have been a broader investigation.
So they were essentially asking whether the safe harbor violated the Human Rights Convention in Europe?
Correct, the Article 8 of the Human Rights Convention, which the Human Rights Convention is older than the Data Protection Directive, but the binding application is newer, and they're asking whether the safe harbor can be evaluated for compliance with that. And, you know, with the recent decision we had by the European Court of Justice in the Google case.
That's right. Those guys are crazy. So they who knows what they're going to do?
Well, there's a bunch of judges. So, you know, you might get a different panel. But
is that right? It's not every judge sitting on all the decisions?
They sit in groups of three in general. So
I saw no sign that we could tell from the Google decision which judges were on that panel.
You know what, I don't know exactly how the court processes work. I'll have to look into that more, but they do follow their precedents. And so, you know, one could expect that there could be a surprising decision on this as well. There's already been Frank will know some more about this as well, but in Germany, there's already been some challenges to the
Data Protection Authority said they weren't going to accept new safe harbor applications.
Yes. Yeah, so we've started to see that, and a lot of our clients are saying, you know, our U.S. clients are saying our counterparties aren't willing to just deal with the safe harbor. They want more protection because there's been challenges to this. So this could be a further step in that direction.
Yes. I think that's absolutely right. It'll be interesting to see what the European Court of Justice decides. I don't think there's a good legal basis for deciding that the safe harbor violates human rights law, but this is an issue on which I think Europeans, including European justices, have a lot of blind spots.
Yeah, I mean, the safe harbor is effectively just imposing the same principles under the Data Protection Directive and letting the FCC have FTC mm-hmm. have jurisdiction to administer
exactly.
It. So they would have to be drawing some very narrow distinction between the Data Protection Directive and the slightly summary version of it that was implemented in the safe harbor.
Well, they could say that you cannot allow data to leave Europe without an assurance about how government handling of the data will be carried out, because there's very little of that in the directive or in the safe harbor. And so they could be saying we're going to really rewrite the directive's export provisions to include a requirement that there be some form of restrictions on foreign government access to the data.
Yeah, fair enough. And actually that triggers a related thought, which is the usual way that countries get out of get favorable treatment for export is the whole country is found to have an equivalent legal system. And there's been no such finding as to the as the U.S., which is related to your government access point.
Yeah, exactly. It would be astonishing if they said that you don't regulate your intelligence agencies in tough enough fashion in the United States when the directive says nothing about intelligence agencies, because that's beyond the scope of European Commission authority. But that would be simply hypocritical, and I've gotten used to European hypocrisy on this issue. Let's turn, if I could, to cybersecurity liability, the practical legal rules that are driving cybersecurity liability. We've seen a lot of litigation recently in which a customer of a bank, not a a consumer, but a small business, discovers that hundreds of thousands of dollars have been ripped off by people who've compromised their credentials and then gone to the bank and engaged in large-scale electronic funds transfers. And the courts have come to different views about when the bank is liable and when it's not. And Michael, there's a new decision out of a federal circuit court that I think offers the banks who have been losing some of these cases a little more hope than they had before.
That's right. These cases are governed by Article 4A of the Uniform Commercial Code, and this is a decision that went the bank's way out of the Eighth Circuit, and the case involves a real estate escrow and title company called Choice Escrow, which opened a bank account with Bancorp South. It turned out that Choice was hacked into using a phishing attack, and somebody was able to get access to employee credentials, and using those credentials was able to get into the company's bank account and stole about $440,000. Choice then sued Bancorp for reimbursement of those funds, saying that it was the bank's fault for letting this fraudulent transfer happen.
And the standard, if I remember, is that the bank has to have commercially reasonable security procedures, and if it doesn't, then it's liable, right?
Right. The risk must be borne by the customer if the bank can show that it has commercially reasonable security procedures for protecting against unauthorized payment orders. And if the bank accepted the fraudulent payment order in good faith and in compliance with the specific instructions of the customer or a written agreement. And in this case, the court found that the bank had commercially reasonable security procedures. It had four different methods for protecting against fraudulent transfers, and Choice rejected two of those methods. So the court basically said, look, you could have had tighter security. The two methods you rejected probably would have protected against this.
As I remember, one of those was you had to have two people sign off on the transfer, right?
Correct.
So it was kind of, yeah.
That kind of dual control, which almost certainly would have prevented the transfer here unless the second party was completely negligent. And the other one was daily transaction limits. You know, that nobody would have been able to make this sort of transfer, at least possibly, if those limits were in place and they were low enough.
So it seems to me that the lesson banks ought to be learning from this is obviously to offer a lot of security choices. The customers probably are in a position where they can't afford to turn any of them down if they want to be able to recover from the banks if they're compromised. They have to accept every single security measure the bank offers them, because if they turn one down, the bank is going to say, well, you turned it down, you made your choice, and now you have to accept the liability.
I think that's right. I think that is going to be one of the messages that banks read from this decision.
And I suppose if you're a bank, you want to offer a range of things that gets harder and harder as a practical matter for people to live with. You might say, oh, you have to have four people sign off, or we get to call your CEO at home before we actually do the transfer. Sooner or later, the customer is going to say, no, don't call my CEO at home. And that'll then become the basis for the bank saying, well, you turned down our security measures, so we don't have to pay it. All right. Well, that's this week in unfortunate security incentives. Anything else that you saw in that case that would be lessons for other folks?
No, I think that was the main thing. A secondary issue was whether the bank had followed the specific instructions from the customer about how to process payments, and the court basically said that the way the bank processed the fraudulent order was consistent with the written agreement between the bank and the customer. So I think that's another thing that both banks and customers will focus on now. They'll be much more careful about what they agree to in advance in terms of how payments get processed.
And I noticed that there have been a couple of settlements recently on the order of $400,000 where banks have said, okay, we'll pay you to their customers. And I think that increasingly banks are getting smarter about which cases they're litigating. And if they think this is going to make bad law or that they might lose, they're just paying up because having good law is more important than a few $100,000 judgments.
Especially when you factor in litigation fees, it ends up not being all that much difference.
Exactly. All right. Well, the other thing that I wanted to talk about, and I'll try to make this brief, but it's complicated, was the Senate Intelligence Committee has released a bill on information sharing. And since information sharing is also something that the House has been supportive of, we actually might see a conferenceable issue there. I've been kind of critical of the Senate Intelligence Committee bill because it's essentially says everybody can share. Government can share. Private sectors can share with the government, with each other. But you have to have certain security measures and privacy measures in place. The reason I've been critical of that is that currently there are no limits to speak of on privacy sharing or on data sharing between particular companies, private companies. And so it seemed to me that what we were getting was backdoor privacy regulation in which people who didn't need protection were getting protection in exchange for accepting a variety of privacy rules. I think that's less true of this bill, but it's still remarkably complicated. The bill says you can monitor your own network or networks where you have permission to do the network monitoring, and you can share information with the government and with the private sector. But if you monitor, you have to have security controls to protect against unauthorized access to your monitoring measures. And if you share information before the sharing occurs, you have to remove any personally identifiable information that isn't directly related to a cybersecurity threat. So on its face, it still seems to have the that unfortunate bargain in which people are getting the benefit of something they don't need in exchange for security regulation. But reading it closely, it seems to me that what this bill essentially does, at least as currently written, it doesn't create any new liabilities. It simply says if you're monitoring, you're not going to be subject to state or federal laws that prohibit monitoring. And that's there's an argument that there are such laws. I mean, Google is famously facing billions of dollars of liability in that case where I think Judge Koh was won the privy for the dumbest privacy decision of the year, in which she said that Google was potentially liable for wiretapping because it was looking at the messages that come in. The same thing is true for anybody who does spam filtering. That is, you are intercepting communications, and if you don't have the consent of all the parties, you're in deep trouble under at least the laws of a dozen states, and arguably you don't even have the consent of the party in some cases if you're a third party doing it under a contract with a company. There are some restrictions on some kinds of companies, mainly electronic service providers, sharing personally identifiable information with the government. So those companies do get a benefit from this bill, as long as they meet those two privacy and security requirements. And if they don't, the only penalty under this bill appears to be that they don't get the immunity. So they in my view, probably insulate Google, or at least make it much less easy to sue Google and certainly spam providers, spam filters for wiretapping as long as they met the fairly minimal requirements for security. And the same is true for electronic service providers. And if you are not currently an electronic service provider and you're in a sharing relationship, there's a pretty good argument that since you're not liable today, you don't need the immunity, and therefore you don't care whether you have taken the privacy steps. But it is complicated as can be, and it would take only a small amendment to turn this into a new big privacy regulatory bill that provides relatively little benefits to most companies and imposes new security obligations and privacy obligations on them. None of this is true of the House bill, so it will be very interesting to see what finally emerges if these two bills do pass and go to conference. So that's my effort to talk about the future of privacy class actions. We've got a couple that are actually kicking around now. I think Hulu had a class action against it that failed, and LinkedIn had a class action that largely failed. Michael, did you take a look at those?
I did, and I'll start with LinkedIn since it involves your favorite judge, Lucy Koh. You would probably consider this decision more reasonable than her decision, at least on the wiretap issues in the Google case.
To be fair, she is the woman who asked a lawyer appearing before her when he made a particular argument, "Are you on crack?" I think it's not unfair to ask the same of her from time to time.
Fair enough. This is a case brought against LinkedIn saying that it broke into users' email accounts in order to pitch LinkedIn to users' email contacts. And LinkedIn said, hey, people consent to this very clearly when they sign up for our service. And Judge Koh basically said that's correct. And she went through the steps of the registration process, and it does seem, in contrast to the Gmail sign-up process, that in LinkedIn's case, there is very clear, explicit consent by users to having LinkedIn mine the email contacts of the users. LinkedIn didn't completely win, though, because the judge allowed a claim under the state common law right of publicity to proceed, and that involved the use of users' names in endorsement emails to, you know, potential new customers. And she said, well, people consent to the first such endorsement email, but there's at least a plausible allegation that they don't consent to subsequent endorsement emails. And she allowed another state law claim to proceed. So the case isn't dead yet, but at least the core issue, which was brought under the Stored Communications Act, was knocked out. The Hulu case is another one out of the same district in California by a magistrate judge. And that one was effectively knocked out when the judge denied class certification. The plaintiffs alleged that Hulu violated the Video Privacy Protection Act, which prohibits video providers from disclosing what video somebody watched without the person's consent. And here the claim was that Hulu was basically disclosing on Facebook what videos people rented. And the judge denied class certification, saying that the disclosures on Facebook basically happened through the use of cookies, and different Hulu users could block the use of such cookies, you know, through various means, including using different browsers for Facebook and Hulu, blocking the use of cookies and things like that. And because separate individuals might use separate means and might actually not actually have had their videos disclosed on Facebook, this required individualized inquiry, so it wasn't appropriate for a class certification.
That's interesting, because my guess is that 98% of users don't do any of those things, clear their cookie caches and try to prevent cookies from slopping over from Facebook to Hulu. But that 2% was enough to kill the class. and that's enough to win the lawsuit. So it's very clear that finding a way to break up the class is critical. I thought the most interesting thing here was the very realistic argument, but the willingness of the court to entertain it, that said, well, look, Judge, that 2%, they're going to lie about it so that they can get on the bandwagon and collect damages along with everybody else, and you don't want to be lied to, do you?
Right, and if it's a class, you know, it's hard to unpack the actual actions of each member of the class, and so I think that's an interesting way to attack classes in the future, you know, to say that it creates an incentive for people to lie, since it's unlikely that the lies will be caught.
Well, I want to save time here for our guest commentator, Ralph Langner. Ralph is the man who really took apart Stuxnet and showed how it worked and what it was intended to do, because he has deep background in industrial control systems that run our power plants, our water treatment facilities, power, and other nuclear facilities, and really pretty much any factory these days runs on its industrial control system. He's a non-resident fellow with the Brookings Institution and has a consulting firm that now advises companies on how to secure their industrial control systems, something that is absolutely critical as people have begun to think about what cyber war might look like. So, Ralph, welcome.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, Stuart.
Can you briefly just describe how you got involved in looking at Stuxnet and what you discovered that was particularly unique to an industrial control system in Stuxnet?
Yeah, certainly. So I'm in this business for a long time. I established my German company back in 1988, and for the last 15 years or so, we have been focused on the security, the cybersecurity of industrial control system installations. So when the news about Stuxnet broke, it was pretty much like we had been training for all those years. So after it became clear in the media that this could have some relationship to industrial control systems at some point in time, we decided to simply download a copy of the malware and check it out in our lab. And from there, we quickly discovered that this was about control systems big time. And from there, the story got bigger and bigger.
Ah, yeah. Okay. So one of the things that many people have concluded from Stuxnet is that as a weapon, potentially a weapon against civilian populations, it has enormous potential, because everything that civilian life depends on is probably ultimately part of an industrial control system. And if you can break those or cause them to malfunction, you can deprive cities of fuel and power and water and run their sewage into their parks. Is that a too frightening a prospect, or is it a realistic
one? No, that's not too frightening, but I would like to add that certainly you also find valid targets in the military domain also. So when we think about future wars, they will definitely have a cyber-physical component, so your adversary will try to disable your weapon systems using cyber means.
Sure. So you've got all our carriers and our nuclear submarines run
exactly
on enormously complicated industrial control systems.
Exactly. And if you just think of any weapon system that has to move around physical objects in order to position itself against the target, that actually this is done by industrial control systems, and this is one area that your adversary would try to attack to disable or at least decrease your responsive capability. But getting back to the civilian part of the story, actually, what most people don't realize, it's much worse. So you can certainly kill people with a cyber-physical attack, which is something that hasn't been discussed in too much detail so far. We haven't seen it, luckily, but it certainly is possible. So if you think about blowing up a chemical plant, for example, by using a cyber attack, then you can and will have casualties.
Or a Bhopal type scenario,
exactly,
where you just open a few valves and let them go.
So you, what an attacker could try to do is to release hazardous material in the environment, which could be toxic or material, or could be radiological material.
How hard is that with today's industrial control systems? Obviously, Stuxnet worked and no one knew what it was doing for the longest time. And even though it was a very, very carefully protected facility, it's hard to believe that power plants and chemical plants are in the Western nations are better protected than the Natanz enrichment facility.
Very good point. So they are much weaker protected than this specific site. But to get back to the question, it is much more easy than most people would think. The good news is that the usual suspects, meaning like the hackers or the hacktivists, they are not capable of launching attacks like this because they lack the engineering knowledge. So for a sophisticated cyberphysical attack, you're actually not attacking the industrial control system. You're attacking the process. You're attacking the equipment.
Mm-hmm.
In order to make that work, you have to have an in-depth understanding of that process, of that equipment.
So you have to know
the
actual process. It's not enough to know industrial control systems.
Exactly.
You actually have to know how chemical plants work and
which
valves do which.
Yes. So you want to make sure that you do the right things at the right time. And this involves knowledge that the average hacker doesn't have and probably will never be able to acquire. On the other hand, you don't need a nation state to actually build up a sophisticated offensive cyber team to do that. So what we're projecting is that in the future, this capability will be used by organized crime, for example, and by terrorists. I think it's quite naive to assume that terrorists will just continue their present strategies forever, like using suicide bombers until for the next 50 years or so.
They have been hijacking planes since at least the 1970s, they seem to not to have lost their enthusiasm for that. I think terrorists turn out to be surprisingly conservative in their tactical choices, but I think you're right. Eventually, I used to say about anthrax attacks that I didn't know where the first one was going to occur, but the second one was going to occur in the United States, and it wouldn't take long after the first one.
Yeah.
As soon as people see something works, then they're going to do it over and over again.
Yeah. So what I think a little bit disturbing is the fact that when you think about terrorism, what you want to achieve is to terrorize. So you want to achieve that psychological effect. And if you would manage to do that using a cyber attack against the United States, I tend to think that the psychological effect would be disastrous because you're kind of suggesting that you're able to attack and maybe even to beat your worst enemy at its own turf in that domain where the U.S. claims to be the number one player, which they certainly are. Unfortunately, they did a poor job in their defensive capabilities. So the U.S. is extremely good, is the leader in offense, but when we are talking about defense, that's a very much different story.
So there was a major attack on oil infrastructure in, I believe, Saudi Arabia, although it's never been fully confirmed. But large numbers of hard drives crashed and unrecoverable. But as far as we know, no effort to jump from there to the industrial control systems?
Well, not in the case you're referring to, which is known as the Shamoon attack.
That's right.
And this was just an attack that targeted IT systems. But there is another incident, or that there has been, I think it was in the 80s, that's on the record, where a group of insiders plotted a cyber-physical attack against the Ras Tanura oil terminal, which is the largest oil terminal in the world. and it was thwarted because the asset owner received information about that attack and was able to stop it in time. So I think it would be completely naive to assume that we won't see full-blown cyber-physical attacks in the future, because they're actually getting more and more easy with the integration of cyber and physical moving forward, like the Internet of Things, like the industrial Internet. So you get more access points by connecting more systems together, and at the same time, the potential amount of damage also increases, which is a very promising proposition for the attacker.
Yeah, it does seem to me that that's particularly troubling. So what would you suggest we should be doing to toughen up our infrastructure to make these kinds of attacks less likely to succeed in the future?
Well, very simple. Just acknowledge in the first place that the problem is real and that you want to do something about it. And the first thing to verify that you actually acknowledge the problem is to look at the resources that you're actually throwing at the problem. The sorry fact is that at this time, most asset owners, I would say more than 99%, have ridiculously low budget to counter cyber-physical attacks. So, I mean, just a matter of fact, recently I made the comment to a client of mine, and it's a global company. I made the comment, well, you're spending more money on the decoration, on the reception area in your headquarters than on cyber-physical security for your global operations. And this is true for most companies in that sector. And until this changes, there is no point in dreaming about how we actually can solve this problem. So, and this is something I find very discouraging about the Executive Order 1336, and the State of the Union address by President Obama. I mean, the word is out there, but there is actually no action. And what I also find frustrating is that the President, in the executive order, didn't specify which level of cybersecurity for the critical infrastructure he wants to see.
Right.
Even if, as an asset owner in the private sector in critical infrastructure, you would try to do the right thing, well, how much are you expected to do from your government?
Right. You can't tell, and the NIST cybersecurity framework doesn't really tell you. It gives you, I would say, a vocabulary for describing your cybersecurity planning, but it doesn't really require any particular level of cybersecurity.
Not at all. The rationale in the NIST CSF simply says, well, you do your risk management, your risk assessment, and based on that and on the individual business needs that you have, you decide on your mitigative actions. And honestly, this doesn't make very much sense to me if you think the whole problem in the terms of national security, because if we want to address national security and try to do that in the mindset and in the economical parameters of the individual business, I don't see how these would fit together very, very well.
But you know, the U.S. is especially these days, for the last 25 years, has been very hostile to regulation of any kind, and I always think that Europe is where American dreams of regulation go to be born, and Japan in its own way also much more regulatory than the U.S. You're not seeing regulatory requirements for cybersecurity in Europe or in Asia?
No, it's coming. But let me get back to this rather quickly. So the fact that that's on the table is what we do see in the United States. The industries that are regulated, they are doing better than others. I have to give you that I'm not pro-regulation. I hate regulation. But if we just take a sober look at the fact, just looking at power, for example, electrical power, what we do see is that even though you can criticize NERC-CIP for many reasons, that the power industry, or at least the part that falls under NERC-CIP, they are doing a better...
The National Energy Regulatory Commission cyber infrastructure program, right? Is that what the SIP is?
Not exactly. That's okay. The critical infrastructure protection for the electrical industry. And the thing is, even if the companies that are not convinced that they would have to do something, they are forced to do something only to avoid fines. Because they were getting fined big time by FERC if there is an inspection and they fail to meet the requirements. So what we see is that this stick approach does show some positive effect. And even it goes so far that parts of the industry are trying to do their own thing in this area to avoid further regulation.
Right.
And this is something that I see very positive, and maybe this was one thinking behind the executive order that the president gave everybody in critical infrastructure a sign, well, you know, if you don't get this fixed soon, we will have regulation.
Right. So that's clearly we heard that message, for example, last week from Tom Wheeler talking to the communications industry. I would have thought that for companies that are concerned about this, that the idea of some sort of quasi-voluntary regulation in which all of the more responsible parties who have enough money to pay for this agree, we're all going to spend some money on this, and there won't be any disadvantage to others because we're all agreeing that we should be spending this amount of money. And yet, when we were talking earlier, you kind of suggested to me that no one feels they actually have enough market power to get the industrial control systems software vendors to produce really strong security.
Yeah, that's the consensus among the asset owners, even though we have seen examples that point to the opposite. So, for example, the German automobile industry is very powerful, and they just have a different culture. They are in the habit of forcing their specific requirements on the vendors.
Yes.
So if you don't play their game, you're out of that game. This works. We still have to wait until the asset owners extend that to cybersecurity. At this time, they don't.
I've seen them in operation when they're talking to their parts suppliers. You know, 20 cents on a part, and you are gone. Everybody it's a little like supplying Walmart too. You are told how to build your product so that it is at the least expensive and meets all the other standard requirements, but they haven't done that yet to their ICS supplier.
That's true, and which is funny in a way, because in this respect, you would also think that such an initiative will be supported by the government, for example.
Right.
It will be supported by independent third parties like my own company. We are getting out the message now for a couple of years. We have to extend that to the supply chain. If we can't do this in a cost-efficient manner, if we only try to mitigate all that risk after the fact, you know, when the systems are already running, and then we try to apply those band-aid mitigations, this is nonsense. And, you know, the critical thing about cybersecurity in the critical infrastructure is we have to find a way to make it more cost efficient.
Right.
Which is one very big hurdle at this time, because the decision makers, they actually don't see the business case.
Because this is a small risk of some disastrous thing that could happen to anybody in the industry, and it might not be them. So it feels a little like a black swan, and they can hope that they can hide behind other members of the herd.
Yes, exactly, which is kind of bizarre, because I could make the point that they will just be flooded away if we see significant sophisticated cyber attacks, which could happen any time. But I was trying to make the point that given the fact that you cannot make the business case for cyber-physical security, and you also accept that, well, you got to deal with that problem somehow. Certainly the priority is on making it cost efficient, and just to squeeze out all those things that don't prove any value. And this is what we try to do with with our company to identify ways how we can turn this into a very smooth methodology that doesn't require armies of consultants who charge high fees. This will not work in the way that we try to approach it over the last decade. So we got to find some more efficient ways how to implement this, and this is where we are working on, and where I would like to see other parties, including DHS, for example, also thinking about some, you know, innovative solutions to the problem. Just repeating the solutions that failed over the last 10 years doesn't bring us any further.
Well, what about, I mean, one of the things that you've taught me is that because the cyber-physical attack only works when something physical happens, you can build in mechanisms like human overrides that can mitigate or prevent a lot of these losses. But that means you have to have more people on site who have more self-confidence and are relying on the machine less.
Well, absolutely. So we are faced with one basic truth, and I have even stated that as Langer's law, quote unquote, that an insecure system or design or implementation is inherently less expensive, more convenient than a secure one. There is no way around this. So if you don't accept this truth, and you're completely driven by the economics of
right.
things, then you will always favor the more insecure solution. The problem is to identify how much security you actually want. I'm not even saying how much you need. I'm saying how much security do you want, and make that happen with the least amount of money. But in principle, certainly you are right that any security control, any a further hurdle that makes the life for the attacker more difficult costs money, and it takes away convenience. No matter if you bring humans back in the loop, so for example, you have guys actually sitting there, they're able to override any decisions made by the control systems, this costs more money. And the trend in automation has always been to get rid of the humans. Let me give you another example. If you avoid the disastrous problems by mechanical controls, for example, avoiding overpressure situations by a mechanical overpressure valve.
Or
hydraulic safety solutions.
But building a clever mechanical solution is often harder than just throwing...
It's not. It's not hard to build or to design. This technology is there with us for many decades.
Okay.
But everybody's throwing this out because the maintenance certainly costs some money.
Yeah.
And it can produce an inconvenience if you have to physically go to the machine, for example, and disable the mechanical control for maintenance, etc. So why not just get rid of it? Because you have that digital safety system and it takes care of everything. Now, the difference is that there is no way.
Plus, the guys who maintain it are unionized, and the guys who run the office are not.
That's one aspect of it. But again, the difference is that there is no way that you can cyber attack an analog system, because no code is running on that analog system. So this is a hard stop for any cyber attacker. And for pretty bizarre reasons, mostly driven by cost, we see all those analog components, like analog safety systems. You don't have to use digital safety systems. The analog stuff is still around, but it's phasing out. But it's more costly. This is where industries are moving. They're completely driven by economy, which is understandable.
Sure.
This leads us to more insecure solutions. Remember Langer's law.
I love it. The bad security drives out. Bad security is cheaper than good security, so bad security drives out good security.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. So last question: if someone were planning a cyber attack, would there be any warning, would you see the equivalent of Stuxnet in your Windows network as it tries to get to the industrial control system? Or was it just bad luck for the U.S. that Stuxnet ended up disclosing itself?
Well, I would actually debate the last part of your question, because I think it could have also been intentional that it was discovered at some point in time. But let me get back to the first part of your question. It depends on the sophistication of the attacker. So if your adversary is top-notch, you will not see any clues. For example, your Einstein 3 system will never catch any of that. If the attacker is not top-notch, let's just say a hacktivist group, they might be stupid enough that you see what they're up to. This is also what we have seen in the case of the pipeline intrusions in the United States. So the attackers made themselves known, obviously non-intentionally. But a top-notch attacker would simply do it silent. For example, I don't need to do much reconnaissance in your own system because I know how that system is structured. I know it from other sites. Don't forget that if you look at a power plant, just for example, or any type of chemical plant, this is not a unique, completely individual design that you are seeing, because the asset owners, the private sector, is marching towards standardization.
Of everything, of course. The entire physical infrastructure is easier if it's the same one as the guy down the street.
It's cheaper.
That's cheap.
It's more efficient. And so if I'm your attacker and I just need to know, you're running the Foxborough control system, and I know how that system works. I know its vulnerabilities. I know the exploits. I know your process. Don't forget, many of those physical processes, like producing power, are very, very basic. You don't need a rocket scientist to understand that. Producing power is basically about boiling water and using steam to then spin a turbine. That's not so difficult to understand. So if I don't need to do much reconnaissance over weeks or years in order to hit you hard, I just need to be good at what I'm doing.
Yeah. Okay. Well, what I fear is that people will start, as I was tempted to do, saying the application of Langner's law is essentially Langnerizing industry, and they are slowly, as they move to a single model for the physical plant, a single industrial control system, where bad security has driven out good security because it's cheaper, the entire industry has been Langnerized. So you may become a verb, too, before you're done here. Let me close off, just because before we finish these programs, we always ask our guests and other participants if they have any upcoming events, speeches, or written material coming out. So if there's something you'd like our listeners to know about, this is the chance.
Yeah, absolutely. So I would like to point everybody interested in cyber security to our website. It's www.langner.com. There you find lots of material, like white papers. We also maintain a blog on that webpage. You'll find recordings of talks of myself. And we also, you may also want to follow us on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is Langner Group. So you will see lots of news about anything that's related to the cybersecurity of critical infrastructure.
Great. Thank you. Maury, any speeches coming up or other events?
Nothing exciting to report today, Stuart.
All right. Well, I am going off to Aspen next week to talk to the Ideas Festival about privacy as a moral panic, and that's my only upcoming event, other than hopefully a little vacation in August. So thank you, Maury. Thank you, Ralph. Thanks, Michael. This has been episode 25 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. I want to thank Maury, Michael, and Ralph, and I hope you'll all join us next week when we'll once again provide insights into the latest events in technology, security, privacy, and government.